From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A look at the new voting rights struggle in the South as activists take on corporate money and politics. And it's the 10th anniversary of ACT UP. We review its history of confrontation and empowerment.
1987, ACT UP first demonstration on Wall Street.
1988, seize the FDA.
1989, four ACT UP members barricade themselves in Burroughs Wellcome's headquarters.
And then we storm the NIH.
In 1989, it stopped the church at St. Patrick's Cathedral.
1992, the Ashes Action at the White House.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In an extraordinary admission, one of the nation's major cigarette makers acknowledged today that tobacco is addictive and causes cancer, and said tobacco companies had for decades consciously marketed their products to children as young as 14. Those concessions by the company, the Liggett Group, the smallest of the country's five leading cigarette makers, are central provisions in its agreement, announced yesterday to settle lawsuits filed by 22 states that accuse the industry of hiding knowledge of the adverse health effects of tobacco. The plaintiffs, including New York and New Jersey, seek compensation from the industry for billions of dollars in annual Medicaid costs incurred by the states in paying for treatment of people with smoking-related ailments. That's a story on the front page of the New York Times, as well as this one. The House voted yesterday for the fourth time to ban what opponents call partial birth abortion, producing more than enough votes to override a near-certain veto by President Clinton. The vote was 295 to 136, a more lopsided showing than any of the three previous votes on banning the procedure, which doctors call intact dilation and extraction. A gay rights group that wanted an anti-discrimination ad to run during the Ellen episode, where the lead character reveals her homosexuality, has been turned down by ABC. Despite the network rejection, the Human Rights Campaign said a majority of local ABC affiliates have agreed to run the television commercial. The ad depicts coworkers expressing surprise that a former colleague has been fired from a job because she's a lesbian. It's designed to build support for a federal law banning job discrimination due to sexual orientation. Hundreds of activists cheered on by country singer Willie Nelson protested the burgeoning growth of factory-style hog farms, saying they're driving small farms out of business. This in Iowa. They marched yesterday on the offices of the National Pork Producers Council, accusing the organization of being a shill for corporate farmers, and demanded an end to a program that raises $55 million a year from farmers to promote pork. An Army veteran who accused the government of exaggerating his role as leader of the Viper militia by 300% was sentenced to 9 years in prison yesterday. Two other members of the Phoenix-based paramilitary group received lesser prison terms. Gary Bauer had faced a 100-year sentence for storing 400 pounds of ammonium nitrate in his basement. The fertilizer is a key component in bombs like the one used in Oklahoma City. A federal jury yesterday awarded the largest ever libel verdict, $222.7 million, to a brokerage that claimed a 1993 Wall Street Journal article contained falsehoods and helped force it out of business. The jury award against Dow Jones & Company includes $200 million in punitive damages to the defunct brokerage firm Money Management Analytical Research of Houston. Dow Jones, which publishes the Wall Street Journal, will ask U.S. District Judge Ewing Werlein to throw out the award. Zairean rebels demanded yesterday negotiations with President Mobutu Sese Seko before a ceasefire, and France urged its nationals to leave Zaire and sent troops and aircraft to the region. This news from Israel: a bomb ripped through an Israeli sidewalk cafe in Tel Aviv today, killing up to four people in what police believe was an Arab suicide attack. At least that's according to Army radio. The radio said it's not clear whether the bomber was among the four dead. And Israeli troops in Hebron confronted Palestinian protesters across the line between the West Bank towns' Palestinian and Israeli-controlled areas today, in the worst unrest since Israel handed most of the city to the Palestinians in January. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Lost in all the noise of campaign finance scandals in Washington are the efforts of hundreds of grassroots organizations nationwide that are fighting to expose and reduce the influence of private money on political campaigns. Over the past days, we've gone to different parts of the country to hear what grassroots groups are doing to challenge the role of money in politics. I'm joined by my co-host now for today's show, Juan Gonzalez, a columnist with the New York Daily News. Good morning, Juan.
Good morning, Amy. How are you today?
Nice to be with you. And we're also joined by Scott Douglas, the executive director of the Greater Birmingham Ministries. The Alabama-based group provides direct services to low-income people, and in recent years, it's begun to take an active role in campaign finance issues. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Scott.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning to you. Well, why don't you tell us what your group is doing now in Alabama around the issue of corporate money in politics?
Well, at the moment, we are concluding research on campaign given to candidates in our last electoral cycle in Alabama legislature in 1994, just trying to track who's giving money to whom and what impact that has on the issues that we are concerned with, issues like welfare reform, tax reform, and education reform.
Mr. Douglas, as I understand it, the Alabama has specific laws that, in terms of campaign financing, that make it even more difficult to track these contributions. Could you explain a little bit about what happens with the money laundering between political action committees in your state?
Sure. In Alabama, our laws still allow for what's called PAC-to-PAC contributions. That is, one PAC can give money to another PAC. We feel that this kind of system allows for essentially legal money laundering so that researchers like ourselves, all we see on the forms that the candidates are required to file is the PAC that actually gave them the money, but it doesn't identify the PAC of origin. So, for instance, if the public was looked very askance at a PAC that was operated by environmental polluter. That environmental polluter PAC can give it to a sweet sounding PAC, and all we'll see on the form is candidate Joe Sims, make up that name, got money from the sweetness and light PAC as opposed to the environmental polluter PAC. Our problem here is that as long as we have PAC-to-PAC transfers, it obfuscates the issues, hides the source of the money, and prevents people from knowing who is paying for the candidates.
Now, what other specific problems do you have in your state? For instance, I understand that there's no limit on how much an individual or PAC can give to a PAC, or?
That's right. There's there's no limit how much there's a limit how much individuals can give to a candidate, but there's no limit on how much a PAC can give. In our last governor's race, one PAC gave a candidate $1 million, one single contribution of $1 million. And so you really can't have a fair election under those kinds of conditions. A second problem that we see in Alabama is that that has the source of money is that individual donors are not required to give their occupation on the reporting form. So, for instance, a company can have or encourage or pressure its employees to give money to a particular candidate, and the form would not show that company as the source. As a matter of fact, we've already it's already been in the press that companies will make a contribution to an employee, and that employee is instructed to give it to the candidate. So it's recorded as an individual contribution when really it's a corporate one, and corporate contributions are limited to $500 per election cycle. And so this is a way they get around that by distributing the money through many of their employees so that it appears as an individual contribution.
Scott Douglas, can you talk about how campaign contributions affect transportation in Birmingham? Birmingham, which is famous, of course, many years ago for the Birmingham bus boycott.
Well, that was the Montgomery bus boycott.
Sorry.
But we are living with the consequences of it. In the 1950s, Rosa Parks sat on the bus, and soon thereafter, Alabama stopped allowing state gas tax monies to be used for public transportation. So I guess they said, if you're going to sit on the bus, we won't pay for it. But here in Alabama, state gas taxes are not allowed to go towards public transportation. And public transportation is very important in our state because here in this era of devolution and welfare reform, in the largest city in the state, there is no public transportation on weekends or at late at night. And the entry-level jobs a lot of people are going to get are those, you know, least desirable shifts on weekends and at night.
Wait, can you repeat that? You mean that in all the major cities, on weekends and evenings, there's no public transportation?
Right. It's a funding crisis, and there is no public transportation. So if you work from 3 p.m. to 11 p.m., you can catch the bus to work, but you can't catch the bus home.
Is there a gas tax or something that can be used?
Yes, but the Alabama passed a constitutional amendment back in the 50s that forbade the use of gas tax, for state gas tax for public transportation.
Forbade it?
Forbade it. That money now goes only for highway construction, and it's the road builder's lobby that stand in the door, so to speak.
So in other words, the state and the working poor of the state are still paying as a result of this this ban imposed from the bus boycott days are still paying for the right to have equality in public transportation.
Exactly. And we make the argument that poor people, working poor, pay gas taxes, and pay disproportionately high because inner-city gas stations cost more than gas costs more than outlying areas. But the point is we're working now to change the law so that we can have that state gas tax collection go into public transportation and not just building highways to the satisfaction of the road building lobby.
Scott Douglas, Alabama is known for civil rights struggles in the 1960s and in the 1950s. You had, as you said, the Montgomery bus boycott in Alabama, then the Birmingham bombing that killed the young girls.
Yes.
You have two senators now, Richard Shelby, who was a Democrat, now is a Republican, changed over within 24 hours of the GOP takeover in 94. And you've got Jefferson Sessions, the former attorney general, who is now a senator from Alabama. And he's also been involved in the civil rights issue. But on the other side, is that right, fighting African-Americans gaining sort of access to vote, or at least dealing with the issue of what he calls voter fraud?
Yeah, that's true. Jeff Sessions, Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions, played a major role in launching the attacks on the voting rights activists in Alabama's Black Belt back in the 80s and was what came up in. And we were able to organize sufficiently in this state, many people were, to prevent his nomination as a judge. But now it seems he's ended up, in all ironies, being on the panel that oversees the nomination of federal judges.
I'd like to ask you, how do the moneyed interests that contribute to these various PACs, what impact have they had on the tax structure, the overall tax structure in Alabama?
That's important. Alabama has the lowest property tax in the nation. We don't have some of the problems that the East Coast and West Coast have in terms of people feeling they're overtaxed. If we double our property tax, it'd still be the lowest. So the big land holding companies and the agribusiness companies exert tremendous pressure on our legislature not to raise the property tax, even keeping a referendum on raising our own property taxes from coming before the public. ALFA, which is the Alabama Farmers Federation, is the big opposition, the single biggest opposition to raising property taxes. We have, they own and control extensive acreage in rural Alabama and literally just blocked the legislature from making any move towards raising those taxes. As a result, we have a very high sales tax to pay for the cost of the state. In many cities, it's 10%.
10%? Now, I also understand there's a sales tax on food in Alabama?
There's a sales tax on food. A sales
we don't
tax.
Even have that in New York.
Well, maybe you can help us, because if bad stuff happens in Alabama, it tends to spread. But there's a sales tax on food, sales tax on prescription drugs. But there's no, and there's a sales tax on baby food, but no sales tax on chicken feed. We have a big poultry industry here.
Amazing.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Scott Douglas, for joining us. Scott Douglas, again, who heads up the Birmingham Ministries in Birmingham, Alabama. And it is an Alabama-based advocacy group that provides direct services to low-income people. If people want to get in touch with you to see how you're working on the issue of corporate money and politics, where can they call?
They can call GBM, we call it, at area code 205 305-326-6821 and ask for Scott Douglas.
That's 205-326-6821. Scott Douglas, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, Juan, you'll be with us for the last segment of the show as we take on the issue of ACT UP around the country. But right now, we're going to turn to the history of ACT UP on this 10th anniversary of the organization. You're listening to the trademark anthem of the ACT UP. The AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. This month marks the 10th anniversary of the group. The founding of the Direct Action Group was not only a watershed event in the 16-year history of the AIDS crisis, but it also had a profound effect on the social and political life of this country. The themes of ACT UP, confrontation and empowerment, going back through the big moments of ACT UP's history in 1987, ACT UP's first demonstration, 17 people arrested on Wall Street as 250 protest drug company profiteering and other issues. In April 1989, four ACT UP members are arrested after barricading themselves inside a Burroughs Welcome office in North Carolina, the issue the high price of AZT. In 1988, a Seize the FDA demonstration. In 89, seven ACT UP members interrupt trading on the New York Stock Exchange floor. Then there was a protest that stormed the NIH. In December 89, some 4,500 people, including ACT UP founder Larry Kramer, converged on St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City to protest church opposition to safer sex education and legal abortion. 111 people were arrested, including 43 inside for disrupting a sermon by John Cardinal O'Connor. And in October of 1992, while the AIDS quilt was in Washington, ACT UP mourners broke through police lines and threw ashes of people who died of AIDS on the White House lawn. Clearly, the AIDS crisis continues, and so does ACT UP. On Monday, ACT UP's official birthday, activists will descend on Wall Street for a national action demanding a reduction in the prices of AIDS drugs. We're going to take on that issue on Monday. But joining us right now to take a special look at the past, present, and future of ACT UP are two veterans of the movement. We're joined by Ann Northrup, a journalist and member of ACT UP for 9 years. She works as a columnist for the weekly newspaper Lesbian and Gay New York, as a co-host on the gay cable network show Gay USA. We're also joined by Eric Sawyer, a founding member of ACT UP and Housing Works, a group that provides housing for homeless people with AIDS. Eric, why don't we begin with you? Can you tell us how ACT UP began?
Well, the official kickoff occurred when Larry Kramer gathered a group of mainly his friends and other interested folks at the community center for a speech at which he trashed our government for its failures to take appropriate action on AIDS. Larry told us how the government had appropriated more than $100 million to test AIDS drugs to attempt to find a cure, and had only spent a few million dollars in a couple of years, and were only testing one drug, AZT. That proved that the government's commitment to AIDS was lacking, and that the $100 million appropriation was just a public relations move. And he called on us to help him put enough pressure on the government to make it get off its butt and do something. Larry, you know, said, hey, what we need is a civil disobedience style group that would do the same thing that demonstrators did for the anti-war movement and the anti-nuke movement. And he asked us there in the room if we would, you know, volunteer to help him plan the first demonstration. And several of us stood up and said we would.
And so how did you do it?
We began by meeting several nights in a row in Larry's living room with flip charts and tape recorders and computers, and you know, started writing demands of what we felt were necessary in order to have the government make some realistic progress. We knew several drugs that had showed promise, according to varying researchers, which had not been tested yet because the NIH had a hiring freeze, which was preventing it from hiring scientists and researchers to oversee any kind of clinical trials. On the spring freeze, start hiring staffing and start getting some of these drugs into people's bodies. We planned, you know, what the march would be. Larry had gotten Joseph Papp at the Public Theater to have a puppet made of Frank Young, who we were going to hang and did hang in effigy.
The FDA commissioner.
The FDA commissioner at the time, yeah. And it was really a pretty exciting time. None of us knew exactly how the public would react. We didn't know how the government would react, although we were holding some negotiations with the police. And by the day of the first demonstration, we actually had prepared for them an arrest list, including the names of everyone who was going to be arrested, and it was very choreographed. You couldn't get arrested unless you were on the list, but it went very well, and thank God garnered a lot of media and a lot of public attention.
Who came up with the name ACT UP?
There was a gentleman in the office whose name was Steve, I think Barber was his name. He died a few years ago. He moved to Seattle shortly after ACT UP started, actually. But it was an effort, actually, that happened during an ACT UP meeting where we were all, you know, sitting around saying, you know, well, what are we going to call ourselves? And several, you know, different groups or several different names for the group were offered up by varying people. And at one point, Steve just stood up and said, you know, I think we should use the name ACT UP. It can stand for the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, which is exactly what we're trying to do. And immediately everyone in the room said yes.
Eric, we're going to have to break. And when we come back, we're going to go back to you, founding member of ACT UP, and also Ann Northrup, a member of ACT UP for 9 years. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our discussion on the 10th anniversary of ACT UP with Eric Sawyer, a founding member, and Ann Northrup, who I introduced before, journalist and member of ACT UP. She co-hosts the gay cable network show Gay USA. And how did you get involved with ACT UP?
Towards the end of the first year, just in time for the first anniversary demonstration, which went back to the Wall Street area. When I got there, there were about 200 people in the room every week, and it was an incredible feeling. I was 39 years old when I joined the group. I'd been around for a while, mostly working at that time as a mainstream journalist. But I had been involved when I was in college as just a regular little anti-Vietnam War protester marching down the street. And in the early days of the second wave of feminism, also taking part in protest marches, but very run-of-the-mill stuff. But when I left the mainstream media and took a job as an AIDS educator to teenagers working for the Hetrick Martin Institute for Lesbian and Gay Youth, and began to find out what was really going on with the AIDS epidemic, which I should have known as a journalist, but to my surprise found out I didn't, I saw immediately that the issues that I'd cared about in terms of Vietnam or feminism were the same things that were going on with AIDS. A government that didn't care, a caste system in the country, racism, sexism, homophobia. And when I heard about ACT UP as a group going out into the streets to protest about all these issues, it seemed to me a very natural home. And with some nostalgia for the 60s, I joined ACT UP, and it was an incredibly, gloriously wonderful experience. And for the first time in my life at age 39, I got arrested in the first anniversary action.
And explain why Wall Street?
Well, a number of reasons, but then and now, the pharmaceutical industry is the most profitable industry in the world. These pharmaceutical companies make a 25% net profit on their gross sales. It's absolutely unbelievable. Most companies make a 6% profit if they're doing well. And they have shown no inclination to really put on the emergency effort needed to find a cure. Here we had Legionnaire's disease cured in about 5 minutes after, you know, three dozen American Legion members got sick at a hotel in Philadelphia. And 16 years into our knowledge of the AIDS epidemic, with 400,000 dead and millions more infected in this country, not to mention the millions and millions more worldwide, we are barely at the beginning of our ability to do anything about it. I think it's outrageous.
Eric, you're HIV positive, right?
Yes, I am.
How long have you been?
I've known that I was HIV positive since 1987. I first tested in 85, but asked my doctor not to tell me the results. I actually had shingles in 1981, so I've probably had HIV for a long time. I've been diagnosed with AIDS since 1991.
Why did you tell your doctor not to tell you in 85?
Because in 85 there really weren't any treatments that were, you know, effective, and I didn't want to know that for sure that I had HIV for fear that I would, you know, get so depressed that I would, you know, will myself to death. And I felt, you know, that, and it was clearly denial, but I felt that, you know, not knowing gave me hope that perhaps I might not be. And, you know, it wasn't until, you know, we started showing a little more promise and I got a little more empowered through being involved in ACT UP that I actually asked him, you know, for my test results, which was about 6 months after ACT UP had started.
And what did he tell you then?
And he said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, I've got to be positive. And he said, well, you've known for a long time, so what's the big deal?
Well, you've clearly kept yourself very healthy.
For someone living with AIDS for 5 years, I thank my lucky stars. Yeah, I've done fairly well. You know, I've watched so many of my friends who, you know, had the same T-cell counts that I did, you know, in 87 die. And often kind of felt like I was on a conveyor belt of bodies dropping into open graves, and you know, have constantly wondered, where am I on that conveyor belt? But I think with the advent of some of the new triple cocktails, my place on that conveyor belt has slipped a little more towards the opposite end of the continuum, and I hope I continue to move away from that open grave.
For listeners who are not aware what you mean when you say triple cocktail, explain.
The newest regime for treatments for HIV involve throwing several drugs to fight HIV at it. I just started, literally in the last couple of days, a new triple cocktail, which involves two antiretroviral drugs, DDI and D4T, and Virucept, which is a new protease inhibitor that was just approved on Friday by the FDA. It's an Aggaron product. And these drugs attack the virus in two different ways, and throwing three different drugs at the virus knocks enough of its steam out so that the body's immune system starts to successfully combat the virus. And I've seen my own T cells increase more than double in the 9 months now that I've been on a protease. but we were going from like sub 100, so hasn't you know, returned me to you know, the healthy person with a normal immune system. Normally, people have in the neighborhood of 1,000 T cells. But I had a fair amount of success for the first 6 months that I was doing ritonavir, 3TC, and AZT, my first triple cocktail. But after about 4 months, the virus started breaking through. My viral load had gone down to around 1,000 and quickly was back up to 50,000.
And when you say viral load, you mean?
Viral load is the number of particles of the virus that are in a milliliter of blood. When I started taking the triple cocktails, my viral load was hundreds of thousands. It went down to 1,300, but within 6 months it was back to 50,000. And so we started considering switching to a new drug and decided to hold out and stay on the ritonavir AZT3TC combination until Virocept was available. And I actually had a prescription for it before it was even approved in my wallet, waiting for the news to come that it was approved so I could hit the pharmacy.
Do you think your health ties into your activism?
I think to a large degree. You know, I know so many of my friends who, you know, went on disability as I did in 1991, who, you know, quickly died thereafter. And I think for a lot of them, they, you know, lacked a will to live or a feeling of purpose. And I think activism has, you know, given me something to get out of bed for every day, and has kept my spirits up and has given me an outlet for my grief and for my anger. And I do think that it's contributed to my being a long-term survivor.
We're talking to Eric Sawyer, a longtime AIDS survivor, and Ann Northrup, a journalist and member of ACT UP. Eric, of course, is also a member of ACT UP. What do you consider the biggest successes of ACT UP? I'll ask you each that question over this decade.
Well, I think the single biggest success is that we've revolutionized healthcare in this country from one where a patient was a victim or a bystander to the process, to one where patients now play a focal role in the design of programs to treat people, you know, living with any type of disease, as well as have had a critical voice in redefining research and how drugs get approved. For a long time, we had to fight for a seat at the table. We had to fight to get into conferences where research, you know, about drugs that were supposed to be saving our lives or about new treatment procedures to treat our diseases were being discussed. And it was like, hey, you know, it's our bodies. You know, we're the ones with the disease. We demand we have the right and we demand to be able to have this information directly from the source. It should be firsthand. And now you see breast cancer and Alzheimer's and, a whole number of illnesses following the ACT UP model of self-empowerment and focus on, you know, a particular disease and activism and advocacy for a particular disease. And I think that's one of our biggest legacies.
I think all that's true, of course. And people with the disease do have a place at the table, are now involved in the planning. I've been talking to someone recently who's a Lyme disease activist who is picking up direct action techniques from us. We've carried on the legacy of direct action from other movements and hope we'll pass that on to others. You may remember the Stop the Church action, one of our most glorious and well-known moments.
Right. Explain that for listeners who don't remember it.
Okay.
Tell us about that.
I'm actually leading up to a point there. In December of 1989, ACT UP staged one of its most controversial and I would say successful actions, challenging the Catholic Church in New York, which was very involved at that time in deciding what the public schools were going to do as far as AIDS education. And the church was on the advisory councils making that policy and was demanding things like no mention of condoms and no explicit AIDS education. We were furious about that. Thousands of children's lives are put at risk by that kind of attitude. And the idea that the church would be involved in public school education was just outrageous. And we debated long and hard whether we were going to do anything about this, because to challenge the Catholic Church, especially in New York, is very risky business. But we ended up deciding that we simply could not stand by while people were dying as a result of the church's refusal to sanction condoms. In fact, we would talk about Cardinal O'Connor's preference for seeing his parishioners in coffins rather than condoms. About 100 of us went inside St. Patrick's Cathedral on Sunday in December and staged what was supposed to be a dignified demonstration while about 5,000 of our compatriots outside were screaming and yelling. Of course, it all turned to chaos, much to our horror, because the mayor, the police commissioner, and others were in there to combat us. It made headlines all over the world and was very controversial. But my favorite reaction to it, and this was what I'm leading up to, was one of our members talked after that to his mother in Darien, Connecticut, to find out what she had thought of this. And she said that she and her friends in the neighborhood had been talking about this, and their conclusion was that before this action, they thought gay people were weak and sissy-like, and after this action, they found out that gay people were strong and angry. And I thought, in fact, that that was exactly the reaction we wanted. And the fact is that AIDS, the silver lining of the awful AIDS cloud is that, of course, the gay community has of necessity been very strengthened and empowered by fighting this. And that's an important outcome of ACT UP.
Eric, what is your assessment of President Clinton?
You know, I thought that he was a good and moral man when he was running for president the first time. He certainly made a lot of promises and had campaign literature that, you know, said all the right things. And
I'm thinking of Bob Rafsky right now,
right,
and his challenge of President Clinton in New York.
When I said to Clinton, we're not dying of AIDS, we're dying of 11 years of government neglect, I was using Vito Russo's words to try to teach him what Vito taught me.
And, you know, I thought, you know, at last we're going to have somebody who really cares about people and really understands what this epidemic means and you know, that it's a true public health threat that is going to kill, you know, millions of young people in their prime. And after he was elected, he, you know, continued to disappoint us as issue after issue came forward, you know, both in terms of his administrative policies and before Congress. And the fact that he, you know, campaigned on health care access for everyone and that, you know, he and Hillary would run around showing these little health cards that, you know, gave a lot of us hope that, yeah, actually people would finally get access to health care in this country. And then to have him, you know, sign welfare reform legislation and health care reform legislation that's, you know, going to eliminate access to entitlement programs and to health care for immigrants immediately and cap, you know, the amount of money that can be spent on health care for any natural-born American citizen in, you know, in a number of, like, 5 years is horrendous. I no longer think he's a good and moral man. I think he's just as corrupt a politician as any that have preceded him. He was just a little better at PR when he was campaigning.
Amen again. In fact, I was a delegate for Bill Clinton to the 1992 Democratic Convention here in New York, and last year, for 96, I was the vice presidential candidate on the AIDS Cure Party ticket, so that may tell you how much I've turned around on Clinton.
Who was the presidential candidate on
Steve Michael from ACT UP D.C. We were on the ballot only in Tennessee, but got enough votes there to come in 21st nationwide of 200 presidential campaigns. We ran radio ads in Al Gore's hometown in Tennessee with explicit condom instructions.
Well, you could have a real effect for the year 2000, considering some leading presidential candidates, both Al Gore and possibly Fred Thompson, are from that state.
Yeah, we've got a real leg up for 2000. Thank you.
Well, I know that you have to go, but I want to just ask, if you feel as strong now after 10 years of ACT UP in moving ahead as you did at the beginning of ACT UP?
I absolutely do. I'm amazed that I've been there for 9 years, but I don't expect to go away anytime in the near future.
And the need, I think, for ACT UP and for other AIDS activists this year is greater than it's ever been before. You know, we do have some promising drugs in the pipeline. There's many more drugs that we need to fight for and get out of that pipeline soon, because many, like myself, have already become resistant to, you know, some of the drugs that everyone is saying are the end of AIDS. And we need to keep the pressure up and fight until we actually do have a cure for AIDS, not just treatments that have horrible side effects and cost way too much money for anyone to afford in this country, and cost so much that no one in developing countries can afford them at all.
Eric Sawyer and Ann Northrup, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Again, Eric Sawyer, a founding member of ACT UP New York, and Ann Northrup, a longtime journalist and longtime member of ACT UP. When we come back, we're going to be joined by two members of Los Angeles ACT UP, and we'll talk about their stories, this on the 10th anniversary of the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we're rejoined by Juan Gonzalez, my co-host and columnist for the New York Daily News, as well as two members of ACT UP California, ACT UP Los Angeles, and ACT UP Ventura County, California. ACT UP spawned many chapters around the country and around the world. Joining us to discuss some of the present-day work of ACT UP and how California, what the California version of ACT UP was. We're joined by Patricia Navarro of ACT UP Ventura County and Peter Cashman, a founding member of ACT UP Los Angeles. Peter, when did ACT UP Los Angeles start?
We had our formation meeting, Amy, on December 4 of 1987, a dark and stormy night. And we kept on going from there, and we're still going.
Now, Patricia, you weren't there at the very beginning, but you came to ACT UP through a personal story. Can you tell us about your son?
Yes, I came to ACT UP when I came to New York City because my son had an AIDS diagnosis. And the very first Monday night I was here, I went to an ACT UP meeting. My son was very involved in ACT UP New York, and it was absolutely phenomenal.
What was your son's name?
My son was Ray Navarro.
And Ray was very well known within ACT UP.
Yes, he was a writer, and he was a political activist, gay activist, and AIDS activist.
Well, Peter, in terms of the development of the Los Angeles group, you've heard some of the the review of what happened here in New York. Has there been a decline in terms of activism and more involvement of some of the original AIDS activists now in what you might call the political superstructure of reform rather than the more direct action involvement that that has so characterized ACT UP?
Absolutely, there has one. You know, we've had calls to reflect on this lately, that ACT UP's been kind of like a university and a college course for many of the people who now work with AIDS service agencies, other social service agencies, and indeed in government, in local, state, and federal government around the country. So, and that's been a plus, but it's also been a minus for the very critical grassroots direct action that is still very much required today.
And has the change in the epicenter of the disease from its original evolution in terms of among gay men to the general heterosexual, especially minority African-American Latino communities, has that had an impact in terms of the level of activism or the attention that's been given by the general society?
I think that it has. And in a place like Los Angeles, where communication is very scattered, organizing is very scattered, it's made it very difficult. It's become very difficult for people within those communities and then for the communities working together to continue addressing these issues in an up-to-the-minute, up-to-date, proactive way. And you know, I kind of despair at times about how we're going to keep on doing the work and make it effective, given those, you know, new challenges.
I wanted to ask which of the large national demonstrations you were each a part of, if you were a part of any.
I was a part of every demonstration between March of 90 and December of 90. I actually went to they were all in New York. I went to Albany in March. The last demonstration I went to before I went back to California was in Atlanta at the CDC, and the issue was women's issues.
And expanding the definition of AIDS to include women.
Exactly. And that was one of the things that my son was very committed to. The minority issue within ACT UP and the women's issues.
You stayed with your son here in New York until he died?
I stayed in New York in different places. For 5 months, I actually lived with another mother who lost her son and her son's lover to AIDS. And that's something that we had in common. Today, I'm staying in an apartment of a woman whose son and lover died of AIDS.
Hmm. I think you are part of that group of heroines and heroes around the country, those that care for people who are in their last days and dying of AIDS, and you know, people that are going through the hardships of losing health care, of not getting the kind of government support that people should get, but who are there and continuing the work of the people who have died.
I'm a mother.
I'd like to ask, in terms of this whole issue of, in the clinical testing, the small number of tests that have been done, for instance, with women as opposed to men, and whether that's still an equity issue in terms of dealing with the disease that needs to be addressed either in direct action or lobbying.
Oh, absolutely, it does. You know, we're still finding that the pharmaceutical companies are not including women in large enough or numbers, or the diversity of women who might be IV drug users or whatever, the diversity of the group of women, and also children are being excluded. And this is creating a barrier in terms of the kind of access that those folks are going to have to treatments, because doctors out in the broader realm of healthcare are going to be reluctant to prescribe for them because, you know, these treatments aren't indicated for women and children. And there needs to be renewed effort on those issues, and it's one that we're trying to redouble our efforts on along with other groups.
Patricia Navarro, you're in rural Ventura County. What kind of work are you doing there now?
I actually do very conventional work. I sit on the Ventura County Advisory Board, Advisory Committee to the Board of Supervisors, and I am actually an appointee of my supervisor from her district. I sit on the AIDS Task Force, and I also sit on the AIDS Partnership, Ventura County AIDS Partnership, which is in partnership with the National AIDS Fund, which is a private philanthropic group, and we raise money and allocate it to the local AIDS agencies.
So you're working with the government now?
No. Well, I don't consider myself working with the government. I'm an advocate, and I'm independent, and I will always be independent. The only reason I serve on the National AIDS Fund Partnership in Ventura County is because they needed representation from the affected community. And there are a lot of people that are just very private about their situation. So I feel very committed and very obligated to be out, for lack of a better term.
And do you see, in terms of the Latino community especially, because obviously that's one of the areas where AIDS is growing still tremendously, do you see still a tremendous reluctance on the part of Latino leaders or others in the community to seriously address the issue of AIDS?
Absolutely. It's interesting you should say that, because I was involved very heavily in grassroots Chicano politics when I left Ventura County to come to New York. I've devoted many, many years to a community-based organization. And when I came back, well, obviously my life had changed forever. But when I came back, I was very sad to see how, people, you know, that loved me were supportive. But I just blew my mind. I mean, you have to understand, I went through a culture shock when I went back. I had lived here for 9 months, and every Monday night I went to an ACT UP meeting. On Tuesday night I went to a mother support group meeting. And I went back to California, and I was supposed to go back to the way things were. I was in such culture shock that I went to ACT UP meetings every week for a year, because I had to wean myself off of the real world that I had been living in and the real world now that I was supposed to go back to.
And the response of the Latino establishment was basically they wanted to keep their heads in the sand and didn't want to...
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I was in such a place of, transition at that point. Mm-hmm. I wasn't willing to take it on. Mm-hmm. So I kind of went to my meetings, and I went to the social things, and I didn't know what I was going to do. It took some time to go through the process, and when I made my decision to focus strictly on AIDS, it took me a while to find that I was already connected in the county. I was already known. I had established myself, so I decided that I was going to use that strength, and that I was going to go back to where I came from, and I was going to take what I learned from ACT UP New York that are still very much part of my life, and I was going to try to see if I could do it. And so far, I've been able to do it.
Peter Cashman, I'm looking at a piece on the cover of the Metro section of the New York Times that has a picture of an ACT UP activist holding a poster, and that poster is the same as your T-shirt. Why don't you read your T-shirt to us?
This T-shirt, well, gee, you can probably read it better than I. Otherwise, I'm going to put some
Patricia.
Joint.
You want me to read it? The government has blood on its hands, one AIDS death every 10 minutes.
That's interesting, one AIDS death every 10 minutes, because the picture I'm looking at here that says, powered by rage, ACT UP protesters used to gather by the dozens, hundreds, or thousands to make trouble and headlines. It's exactly the same red handprint, sort of a bloody handprint. But it says, one AIDS death every half hour. You're now up to one AIDS death every 10 minutes.
And in fact, this is an old shirt. It got up to about every 7 minutes. And internationally, if we look at the global situation, there's two AIDS deaths every second.
Two AIDS deaths every second.
And we got down to about one AIDS death every 7 minutes in the U.S., but we're now starting to push that back. We're going 12, 15, but internationally, it's horrific.
So where do you both see the future of AIDS activism now in 1997 as we move into a new millennium?
I would have to say that coming from Los Angeles, where political organizing has always been very difficult, I think that is an incredible challenge. We have to reinvent ourselves. I think that maybe the only way that we're going to reinvigorate is simply by people feeling more threatened. And I tell you that with what is happening with welfare reform, pending spending caps on Medicaid, the collapse of the AIDS drug assistance program again in California and in Los Angeles County, that hopefully that is going to drive people back to the kind of independent direct action. And I stress that independent direct action is very important. We've had so much partisan activity, which is valuable, but we need to have that broad independent action. But it's going to be a tough job. I don't know if we're going to be successful, but we're trying. And hopefully these events of this weekend and the ongoing focus on this 10th anniversary might be a catalyst in that process.
Well, there was so much hope some years back, I guess, when President Clinton was first elected on the AIDS front as well as in many other fronts, that there would be some major reforms or changes in the way the government dealt with the problem. Do you find now, after these several years have passed, now a certain letdown in terms of what was expected from the government and what has occurred?
Yeah, I think that it's been image over action. We have seen a pickup on in the terms of funding, but that was a past due bill. We go back to the Ryan White Care Act, which was the first federal act that really put a lot of funding into AIDS care and treatment. Back in 1990, it was costed out at $860 million. We got $125 million in the first cycle, way below the need. We only actually came up to that level last year, so we've got that money. But the funding isn't meeting the need, and very sadly, the really key initiatives in the areas of education and prevention are really not going ahead. Our AIDS education is in a shambles, and the key prevention issues like needle exchange are still not going forward.
Are you both going to be at the demonstration on Monday on
Absolutely.
Wall Street?
Wouldn't miss it.
Well, people will be converging from around the country, and we'll be there as well. We're going to take on the issue in Democracy Now! Of the price of drugs and the responsibility of pharmaceutical companies. So that's what we'll be doing on Monday on Democracy Now! We want to thank you both very much for joining us, Patricia Navarro of ACT UP Ventura County and Peter Cashman, a founding member of ACT UP Los Angeles. Thanks for taking the time to drop by.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Juan.
Thank you.
We want to dedicate today's program to the memory of Spencer Willitis, who died suddenly last December in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Spencer was a longtime community activist, a father, a husband, and a regular listener to Democracy Now! He was instrumental in helping to get the program back on the air at KUNM in Albuquerque, and we are sure he would have enjoyed today's program. Well, that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy of it, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our engineer and assistant producer. And we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. And if you're not quite conversant on the net yet, you can just send us a plain old letter. Why don't you send it to us at Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. That's Democracy Now! At Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Six, seven, eight, nine. What I use in a battle for the mind. Hit it hard like it's supposed. Pulling up blows to the nose like Uncle L said. I'm ripping up shows.